Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Robert?
I'm feeling collaborative. And
that's a nice feeling. Why?
It is. Well, for many, many reasons. Because since I've been stuck in my house for the last few weeks, I've been really reflecting a lot. And I'm feeling incredibly lucky and thankful for the life that I have. And I know that we do create our own lives for ourselves. But at the same time, you can't do it without other people that you care about and love. And those people are, majority of them are artists in my life. And I feel like my whole reality wouldn't exist without them. And I know that I'm a kind of cheerleader and supporter, and, you know, even through the gallery work I do, you kind of look after people, but I have to have people to look after. And without art, then my life wouldn't really exist in the way that it does. And there's an amazing quote by our guest who we're going to be speaking to today. And she said that nothing happens without the work. And it was in a question and answer session recently. She currently has a show at the New Museum, which is on hold because of this quarantine time. But she did a wonderful question and answer at the beginning of the show. And that was advice she gave to artists. And it really struck me, because even though I'm not an artist, it's so true. Like, my whole life wouldn't exist without artist work or art. So I'm feeling thankful and grateful for that. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art, Jordan Castile.
That wasn't the best introduction I've ever had in my life.
It was, or it wasn't.
Thank you. It was. That was the best introduction I've ever had.
Oh,
I really appreciate that. And you nailed it. And I love that that's the quote that you picked, because it is the philosophy. It's probably the one that comes out of my mouth most frequently.
Is it really?
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. That. Nothing happens without the work. It's the thing I repeat the most to my students and people around me. So I truly
do
believe that.
It's true, though. And like, talking about your students, one of the reasons I really, and Russell and I both really wanted to talk to you, is because of you've taught a lot, and you're actually quite a young person yourself, but you're actually a really sort of successful teacher. Mm-hmm. And I find that so inspiring, because even us doing this podcast, it's all kind of about education and us learning, and then by default, our listeners learning. And what was it for you that kind of led you to that, to be a teacher at such a young age?
Truly, from as far back as I can remember, I've always been drawn towards being in educational seeming roles. So I would spend my summers when I was in college going to nonprofits that worked in the arts and working with young people. I just always loved babysitting. I remember being quite young. At 12, I took my first CPR class so that I could learn CPR and get certified, like a babysitting certification, just because I loved being around kids. And I would pace the block and like pass out flyers to try to get people to like hire me as a babysitter, which is totally creepy now. So I definitely was living the young entrepreneur dream. And yeah.
I thought you meant you hand out flyers for people to do CPR on them.
Oh no, it's true. On the flyer, it said I was CPR certified, which might have been a signal of maybe brilliance.
Worry,
or
yeah,
exactly. As a young parent,
negligence.
But,
yeah.
It's a 13-year-old girl pacing around with her wagon, passing out flyers saying, "I know CPR. Let me take care of your children." But I think that has innately been a part of who I am. That I've always been kind of community-driven and focused, and always saw opportunities to like learn from others and then share my learnings with them. That it's awesome. About kind of a mutual exchange. And it's evolved in different ways. It's gone from my wagon to teaching special education in Denver after college for a year. I taught special education.
That's where you're from, isn't it, Denver?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Denver, Colorado, which was a magnificent experience having the mountains as a landscape. But then I literally kind of went off to Yale somehow, which is a whole nother story. And then now I'm teaching again. So it feels really cyclical in my ability to kind of return to the things that are truest about myself, and education and painting or making in general are kind of the two most consistent things. If I were to think back on my life, that were innately who I was just part of who I am as a person. Wow.
Right. Are you able to teach now then while you're, because we're all in lockdown, are you finding, are you doing this whole Zoom thing that everyone's involved in and teaching students that way?
Yeah.
Do you have people relying on you right now to get them through certain grades and stuff?
Totally. So, I mean, I teach advanced painting, which is very difficult under these circumstances without a doubt, because a lot of my students live at home still or in living circumstances where there are multiple people sharing small apartments that they don't necessarily have the space or the materials anymore to continue to paint. So we've really had to kind of push creative thinking to its brink as we try to figure out how to best support their painting practices. Mm-hmm. And what I've really kind of come down to is that their painting practice matters, but it's really an opportunity to be a mentor more than anything, and a guide and a support for them in their kind of emotional and physical being. There's ways to be creative that may or may not involve actual paint. So I am teaching, and I'm teaching on Fridays, and I've kind of, they call asynchronous and synchronous learning. So I've tried to do a lot of asynchronous learning so they can kind of come in and go as they please or as they need because they're working and set up kind of calls like this. Like, I've actually used my network. I made a call to a lot of my friends and artists saying, would you guys do 20-minute pop-ins with my students? Just to try to keep them. Yeah, right? I'm super excited about it.
Like, so guest, I've already got guest crits sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. But not even like formal crits, just like guest pop-ins, just like guest hello, I'm an artist, I'm living and I'm working.
Oh, that's awesome.
Ask me some questions.
Ask me questions. Share whatever they want.
And you've been setting this up in your bathroom, haven't you? I saw on your Instagram.
Oh, yeah. Everything's in my bathroom right now. That's where you just had me leave to get closer to the router. That's the only place I have a door in my apartment because I'm in a studio apartment. So when there's work to be done, my partner sees me disappear into the bathroom.
That's where your best work is made, right,
that's
Jordan?
That's where
everyone wants to
wonderful.
Know.
Exactly.
Amazing.
Don't tell people my
and
secrets.
And your show, which is currently installed at New Museum, is portraits of students at Rutgers University where you teach.
Yeah, so those paintings are included in the show at the New Museum. That exhibition features nearly 40 paintings that kind of span the past 7 years of my career. But the first room that you enter when the elevators open is a room with, I think, almost 8 paintings of all my students. So your first encounter with my work is of the paintings of my students. And it's the most recent body of work that I exhibited at Casey Kaplan Gallery here in New York City in November of 2019. So it's pretty powerful, without a doubt, to walk in and be greeted by these young minds in their creative spaces.
Is that pretty amazing to have done them paintings in 20... When did you paint them? 2018?
In 2018, 2019.
So is that quite amazing just to do them then and then for them to suddenly be in a museum?
Oh, it's unreal. I mean, much of exhibiting paintings in general in an institutional capacity feels totally unreal to me because as a young person, I would enter museums and be like, oh, wow, these are things that have already been determined for me as important. And I don't know how they got there, but I know I'm supposed to know that this is like valuable in the context of culture or whatever. And now it's me. It's my works on the wall. It's absolutely absurd. I walk in and I'm like, is this real? Like, I'm sure this is
a dream.
A hoax. Yeah, it's a hoax of some sort that it's going to be a magical wall that disappears and I'll see something else behind it. And it's
someone
not
else's
own.
Work. Yeah,
you're yeah,
like, oh,
exactly.
It is a bud. You've titled your show Within Reach is the name of your show at the New Museum. What does that title mean for you and why is that important?
So that title, I think, is twofold. It is the title of an actual painting that's being exhibited in the show called Within Reach, and it features a young man kind of crawling across their caretaker's lap, and you can't see what they're reaching for, what this young person's reaching for, but there's kind of a real sense of movement and engagement. It feels clear that there's a caretaker or maybe a parent. The legs of the person they're crawling over are bigger than their own. Mm-hmm. So I love the idea that there's a painting that has inspired the title. The painting is actually exhibited in the work. But then the notion of within reach, that my relationships with all of these people have always been within reach. The paintings represent living people, real people in my life. Mm-hmm. And those people were oftentimes genuinely within my orbit already, that they were already within reach of my kind of expansive realm of thinking and engagement, right. That our ability to connect with one another, even if you're in England, you're in London right now, and I'm here in New York City, that everybody and everything is within reach if we just take a step outside of our comfort zone and figure out ways to connect with one another.
Definitely, definitely. I think for me, one of the reasons I first connected to your work was this sense of intimacy and almost like a close proximity to the people that you're painting. And I remember a painting from 2017 called Yvonne and James. And I loved that painting. And I think I first saw it through the internet. And I remember just, it spoke to me. Like, their stare was so kind of welcoming and sort of warm. And you felt the sense of their warmth to you. And also the way that their hands were like holding each other's hands. Like, it's just the most touching, wonderful portrait.
I love hearing you say that because it's one of my, if I were to have favorites, I often say that I don't because they're like my children and they're living people and I don't want anybody to get mad at each other.
Oh,
like,
yeah, to get offended.
Yeah.
Popularity like contest. Yeah.
You're like, exactly. Sorry, mom, you're not my favorite painter.
But there is a real emotional connection for me that you're describing. What's unbelievable and what I love about painting is that I have, as the first person kind of relationship to that painting, have a really emotional connection to it. I have the history and the stories. But to hear that you felt that through the way that it's painted and that their kind of hands are grasping one another is really magnificent as a maker to know that I've achieved that, because that's always my intent. But that painting really represents for me two people, James being somebody who I painted first when I was at Studio Museum in Harlem. He was one of the first kind of street casting scenarios where I was approaching people on the streets in Harlem. And he was somebody that quite immediately welcomed me into his environment with real grace and enthusiasm. And when he saw his painting for the first time, he was so excited that he ran away, like literally ran away. He was like, oh my God, this painting is like bigger than I thought. I thought it was going to be a drawing or something. I have to go get my wife. And then his wife came back and was so taken by it that she flung her arms around me, started to cry and say that she saw me as somebody who represented somebody that she loved, her husband, in the way that she had always seen and known him, that was a real gift. I know. Wow. So it's a story that often makes me cry, and I'm working really hard not to, but Yvonne passed away about a year ago, and that painting in particular, I think, really highlights the love that is embodied and was embodied in their relationship. That she, from that point on, when she first met me and flung her arms around me, was like, I am committed to you, and you are committed to me, that you are our daughter.
You're connected.
Yeah. And she literally will call me every week just to say, hey, baby girl, like, we just want to tell you we love you. What's going on? I met my parents, and none of that would have happened if I hadn't have just taken the risk to say hello in the first place. That it was just within reach of my day-to-day commute, this relationship that has changed my entire life.
What was it about him? What is it about subjects that you're drawn to?
Yeah, I mean, I think it changes. Not really. I don't know. There's something very intuitive that happens when you are moving through space with the intention of trying to capture someone's essence and energy. The painting of James in particular, that day, I had walked past James, but there was this, like the clouds had kind of parted. It was a coldish day. And I remember the clouds parting and this beam of light literally landing on top of his head that made him look like a bronze statue of like glory. Like it was like, oh my God, if that's not a painting, I don't know what it is. Like the universe literally delivered a painting in front of me. And I was terrified to say hello. So I walked past him. Ultimately came back because I had enough internal dialogue to yell at myself to go back. Mm-hmm. And then there was just a softness in his eyes. And I think that's generally true with the subjects that I encounter and the people that I choose to paint or photograph, is that whether it's me going out and meeting people for the first time or they're people that I've known and have thought about wanting to paint for some time, mm-hmm. there's something intuitive that that happens that I just have to like trust it. Where you feel the sense that people are letting you in, and you take that kind of cracked door and you fling it open, and something really beautiful can happen. So usually it's a return gaze in some capacity, that people are expressing some curiosity about me in the same way that I'm expressing curiosity about them. And
Do you ever paint your subjects more than once? Do you ever like do
James
a
is one
style?
Of the James is one of the only people that I painted more than once. James and Falu. So there's the painting of Bay Falls. And that's the first time I painted Falu with her brother on the street in Harlem in front of the Studio Museum. And then Falu was able to bring her street vending venture into an inside shop. And when she got that inside shop, I went back and photographed her in that space. It felt really monumental in her life to have a space like that. And so it felt right to go back and photograph and paint her. And then the painting of James and Yvonne, it was the same thing.
Do people think you're a photographer then, first and foremost? Because you take photographs first and you work from photography, don't you?
Probably. I mean, when I approached James that first time, like he said, he thought I was just going to make a little drawing or something. Like I was somebody who came up to him and was like, I'm a painter holding a camera looking lost. Like he was probably like, yeah, I'm just going to do this young person a favor because she's nice enough. And had no real sense that it was going to become a painting. So I'm sure that people could easily mistake me as a photographer first, but I do not consider myself a photographer, and I try to make.
So you don't show photographs.
People.
You don't.
I
show
do.
Them. You
I show
the photographs,
them paintings.
Yeah.
I do show them like paintings, like.
No,
I'll
but
be like,
I mean publicly, the photographs you've made of the subject. No. Do you ever show them anywhere, or do they exist for the public, or is that just for your archive?
Just for my archive, because there, I mean, I am in partnership with a photographer, so I have learned quite quickly that there is a lot involved in photography that I don't care about, quite frankly. I really am just using photography as a tool to kind of document. It's like a documentarian where I'm just going out and taking 100 photographs with no real kind of focus in mind. I'm not literally sometimes not focusing my camera. I'm just like clicking away, and so they just become reference material for me in the studio.
I was going to say because the thing is, you're taking photographs, but the paintings look like you're sort of sat in front of these people.
Yeah, they're
painting
sitters,
them, almost like life drawings. Like they're so full and like and rich and alive. Like that you know you can feel the presence of these people. Like it's
like they're in front.
I can't
of you,
believe that it's all from photography. You know, initially, it's such an interesting thing.
Well, I love that that's the case because I've worked really hard to try to get that as the feeling for the viewer because I love life painting. I did it when I was in graduate school. I was painting from life, and the transition to using photography as a tool happened when I decided to scale up and make the canvases life size or larger, that I really wanted the subjects to be a certain scale. And I realized that I couldn't necessarily like lug around my canvases into people's homes and expect them to sit for extended periods because I cared a lot about going into their spaces. I didn't want them to just come into mine. That for me, it was about an exchange and a willingness on my part to kind of meet them where they are. And in order to do that, photography became a means to achieve that. But it's not a one-to-one relationship between a photograph and a painting. And I think that's partially what allows you to feel that it's painted from life, is that I do allow myself to kind of recreate the environment and to pull in things that maybe were 3 or 4 feet away into the canvas and into the composition in order to kind of allow the viewer to access the things that I observed in that moment.
That actually feels like quite a new development for me in painting, in the sense that instead of it being that traditional model of like somebody coming to an artist studio and then either taking their clothes off and being the life model, that you're actually like collaborating with the people that are in your portraits.
Yeah,
so it's a very collaborative process.
Oh, the word collaboration is always on the forefront of my mind, that I want them to feel empowered and powerful. Right. And I want that to happen from the beginning of the process all the way to the end, when the painting is living its life in a gallery or a museum, that the gaze is part of that. So that the one thing that I ask of the sitters in that moment, they can sit however they want. They can tell me what things they want in it. They can kind of direct the image or the shot in a lot of ways. But the only thing that I ask is that they look at me when I take the image, take the photograph, and then that's something that I replicate in the paintings, because I want them to be active, not passive, wherever they go. That I fully recognize that, like a baby that I am nurturing, that there's a point, like my mother had to let me out of the nest and hope that she had put within me all the values, all the skills I would need to fly on my own. And that's how I see the actual painting process as developing, that I have to kind of put into it all the things that it needs in order to kind of live a successful life outside of my nest. And the gaze and the scale is a part of that.
How many paintings do you do at once, and how long do they normally roughly take?
Oh, speed dating has never been something I've been capable of doing. And I feel the same way in the canvas realm or painting, that I can't like dabble over here and then dabble over there. Like I have to give my full attention to one painting at a time, which drives, I mean, sort of nuts, but it's like literally the only way I can
work. You're a monogamous painter.
I am a monogamous painter.
You're not in an open relationship with your studio.
Not in an open relationship. I'm totally like, I see you over there. I'm going to get to you in a minute, but I need to focus on what this baby needs.
I've got to do this relationship first.
What this baby needs is like my full-blooded attention. So I will take the time to mix all the colors for that canvas particularly. And then I work in sort of like sections. So I'm a completist even within the work itself. For example, I will do the entire face in one sitting, and I won't go back and I won't work in it again. So I'm working wet on wet, which I think is another tool for me to allow the feeling of freshness that comes from painting from life, as I don't allow myself to fuss too much. That I give myself a kind of time frame. I have 3 hours. I'm going to work on the face. When the face is done, it's done. The next day, I'm not going back in and rendering it any further. That it's really kind of at its end. And then I'll move on to the hands. And then I'll move on to the jacket. And each of those sections will get completed in one or two sittings to kind of build the painting together. My best friend, who's in sales, often describes my painting practice as like a giant coloring book. And I think she's sort of right. She has distilled it to the easiest form. Of course, but she's absolutely right. I build these outlines and then I fill them in, similar to a coloring book.
right, in sections, yeah. That's amazing.
You're
obviously, you are an incredible, incredible artist, but are there any bits that you struggle with? You're just saying about like the face, the hands, the clothes. I mean, do you ever find like when you get to the ears or the feet, you're just like, oh, fuck this. This is my least favorite part of the painting.
It is the details. So those couches with all the floral bits or like...
I love that though, the floral
but
elements and the
too.
Prints in your paintings I go crazy for. And like the small photographs in the background. Or like, you know, like all those interior details are kind of what I love so much about your paintings.
Yeah. Well, I love that you love them, because I'm hating myself the whole time I'm making them. Those are the moments that I'm literally like kind of cursing under my breath and like counting the seconds. Oh, it drives me nuts. But I love it afterwards. Like when I was in graduate school, I remember doing the first couch, which was the painting of Jouret, which is on view at the new museum right now. But he's sitting on, it's a nude figure, and he's sitting on this floral couch, and he has this plant kind of drooping next to him, and all you see are the outlines of this plant. And I decided to do this floral, well, I didn't decide to do the floral couch. He decided to sit on that floral couch, and then I had to paint it. But the way that I decided to paint it...
Because that was really special to him, wasn't it? That was an important couch or something. Yeah,
exactly. It was a friend of ours' couch, actually, because he didn't have furniture at the time, which was a whole other story. So we ended up having to kind of like find an object in the world that he cared about and then go there. But when I started painting it, a friend of mine in graduate school, Heidi Hahn, was like, why do you make this so difficult for yourself in the way that you're painting the leaves on this plant? Like, I literally would draw and paint in, like a coloring book, each individual leaf. Like, I wouldn't do a layer of paint and then paint on top of it. Like, I literally outlined everything. I made it so difficult for myself. And I continued to do that. And it continues to drive me nuts. But the result does make me really happy. Like, I love that you can see the paint kind of edge up, one, the juxtaposition of the paint. And sometimes you can see the underpainting beneath, just beneath it. And I like that you can kind of really feel my hand in those moments. Mm. But while I'm making it, I hate it. So those are real struggle points for me emotionally. Wow. It's grueling.
And so something I really wanted to speak to you about was, there's a painting of you where you paint yourself. And this self-portrait, it's one of, again, like, it's one of my favorites. I love that painting of you. And how does it feel when you actually then either take a photograph of yourself, or I don't know if you paint yourself in front of a mirror, or how you do those ones, but is it a very different sort of process to make a self-portrait?
Yeah, I mean, I very quickly, so that self-portrait, I think, was done before I even went to graduate school. I assume the really? One you're talking about, I have the IV in my arm, and like these, like, they're in yes. the backgrounds. I pasted in letters from my students from special education when I was teaching.
Exactly.
I pasted in the background all the like goodbye letters, because I at that time, my health was really starting to deteriorate, and I have lupus. And at that, I'd started these kind of, what is it called? Like trial medication, infusion medications. It was a uh-huh. clinical trial that I started participating in. So I did this really vulnerable painting, like really vulnerable painting, and I really yeah. needed money. And somebody reached out and asked to buy work, and he offered to buy that painting. And I didn't think twice about it and sold it. And now I look back at it and I'm like absolutely horrified that I sold it in some ways, because it is such a vulnerable representation of myself that I then
think that's why I love it so much though. And you know, like some yeah. of my favorite paintings are like Frida Kahlo's, you know, hospital paintings, oh, yes. or even Tracy
totally. Ellis.
Like so I think that that's actually more to do with me in a way, because like that's
yeah.
the kind of work. Like I own hospital drawings by Tracy, and
oh, you know, wow.
even abortion monoprints. Like I'm very much into kind of those narratives of like
yeah.
making yourself vulnerable in art, which is why I think it speaks so much to me. Probably
that makes a lot of sense. And what I realized was that I actually didn't have the capacity to be that vulnerable in art. In my first year in graduate school, I actually made a lot of work about having lupus. I made a lot of these like little pill bottle paintings, and I did quite a lot of self-portraits. And then I realized that I didn't like being front and center. And I also mm-hmm. didn't like the vulnerability or the capacity for people to kind of tear an image of me apart emotionally or philosophically or whatever, that was a part of me that was so kind of personal that I didn't want to put it out there. So I very quickly made the shift, and the work that I've sort of become known for is a lot of the work that has happened after that, which was my second year in graduate school, starting with the Visible Man series and then leaving and doing the Brothers series. But what I've found for myself is that I love telling the stories of others, and that my vulnerability exists as an artist by being willing to put my hand on display for others to see, and that I very much see myself in the work itself. So, for example, the Visible Man series, there was a time where people would say that I only painted Black men, which was true to an extent, but it felt sort of limiting to the fact that I was a Black woman making that work, and that I looked mm-hmm. at the work and I saw so much of myself within it, that it felt like to say that I only painted Black men was negating my voice as a Black woman and my hands and the power of making large canvases and portraits of people and trying to inject them into the art historical canon. So all of which is to say that that self-portrait is probably the last for a very long, I can't imagine the next time that I will do another. I have a lot of gratitude for it, but it was sort of sad to see it go.
Yeah, fair enough.
And now I look at it and think, I wish I had kind of kept it maybe closer to my heart and to my own kind of thinking. But it's crazy to think that that was so early on in my practice and how the practice has sort of held on to some ways. There's similarities in the way that I was painting now. Painting now.
Even the print and then the kind of collage letters in the background, like all of
exactly.
that. And that's very much what I think about when I think about your work. Like it's not even just the people that are being portrayed. It's very much the whole composition and also technique. They're kind of bigger than just being figurative paintings to me. Like they're more expansive than that.
Yeah, and for me, it is about humanity at the end of the day. Yes. The things that matter for me are these human relationships and vulnerabilities and authenticities. And being authentic with myself and with others and trying to represent them as such is the core and the crux of the work, kind of theoretically speaking. So, yeah, it's kind of a remarkable moment to see its evolution and to have that on display even now at the new museum, to look back. There's a real opportunity to kind of look back and find the threads through the practice.
How are you finding it at the moment then? Because with the show being on pause, how is that affecting you, like your feelings about it? Because that must be really like heartbreaking, but also how are you making work at the moment? And is it affecting the way you're making work, and what sort of scale are you working at?
Yeah, so it's a double-edged sword. One end, 3 weeks ago, I started therapy again because I was so overwhelmed by the like visibility the show was bringing. That I was really having a hard time being, as somebody who has chosen not to do self-portraits and put other people on the forefront, was with real intention. I never really grasped the idea that my face would become recognizable around the practice. And so I was really struggling with the kind of exhaustion factor of my schedule, the things were becoming really busy. So there was part of me that 3 weeks ago.
You're becoming a famous artist.
Well, according to my nephews, definitely, because they called me the other day and said, "Oh my God, Auntie, you have a Wikipedia." And that was it. I was like, "Oh, game over." My
it's nephew, official.
My nephews will never see me the same. I talked them out of that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser's also given people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
But yeah, there was part of me that thought, like, oh, I had been asking for a break, and here it is that I had been craving and needing, like, downtime. It's just come in a way that puts a lot of life at risk, which is a real tragedy. So I feel a sense of, yeah, grieving around having prepared for this show for months and then kind of see it so quickly kind of disappear in front of my eyes, but then having to rethink how to engage with that it's still something that happened, and it happened at 31, and it happened in New York City, and there's so much to celebrate about that. And this career of mine is one that I hope will last for many years to come. So there will be more opportunities, and staying grounded in that is the way that I'm moving forward. But my partner, because of my lupus, I am a high risk category. And so my partner and I, quite early on in all of this debacle, got an easel and some of my smaller canvases out of my studio and brought them into our studio apartment. So we have zones officially of our apartment. That's basically the best way to describe it. It's like we have the kitchen zone, we have the like living room zone, the bed zone, and now
you claim the bathroom.
Yeah, I claim the bathroom, and then we took apart our dining room table and set up my easel in that space, and have kind of these small. I'm doing some of the small crop paintings. I had a whole bunch of images from being on the subway already ready to go, and I had small canvases ready to go for those images, so we brought those home. And I've actually found it quite difficult to paint in this space. I think my home zone has always been one for relaxation and for not thinking about work, and it feels like my Geordie part of myself, which I think of as my like home part, but the people who know and love me most intimately call me Geordie. And then there's Jordan Castile as an artist and painter, and all of a sudden those zones are intermingling, and it's been kind of difficult for me to focus on painting. So I've started a painting. I've spent probably in total 5 hours on a painting in the 3 weeks I've been home. But I have made a lot of bread on the other hand. So I'm keeping my hands busy. I don't know how to sit still. I just can't paint. So
do you sketch,
I'm making sourdough bread.
Would you go straight
to painting? Never been much of it. Yeah, I kind of go straight to paint. I sketch on the canvas with paint. And that's kind of where it all starts. But I'm generally not I'm always sort of embarrassed to say that because I feel like real artists sketch all the time or something, which is my own kind of like falsehood. But I don't sketch all the time. I'm not necessarily that person. So I exercise my creativity in other ways, and knitting or baking. And
Oh, really?
You're so crafty, Jordan.
Oh, I'm very crafty. That's the part of me. That's what I'm saying. The little baby Jordan was like running around with my wagon and I was passing out thing flyers, but I was also like making mobiles out of popsicle sticks and hanging them all over my wall. Oh yeah. I was always, my mom jokes that even as a young person, all I would want for Christmas was a box of things from Michaels. Like that's all I would write on a Christmas list.
What's Michaels?
Michaels is like a craft supply store in the States.
A box of crap from there that you can just then make stuff out of.
And she said she would just go up and down the aisles and be like, pom-poms, throw it in, like twisty things. I don't even know what that is. Throw it in. Like hot glue gun was always something I needed. I always needed some glue sticks. But if I could have stuff, then I could make anything. And that was my escape as the young person. And it's still that way now that my hands always need to be moving. I'm just not always able to paint in like a formal capacity.
Did you ever think you'd be a sculptor then, talking about
no.
that? Like,
Nope. I mean, I was making mobiles, but they weren't good mobiles, and I knew that even then, or I was like, I think no part of me is good with tools. I'm quite clumsy, actually, and very frequently drop even my paintbrushes. So if I had a saw in my hand, I think it would probably be...
You wouldn't have any hands left, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. It's better to keep a brush than a saw.
So thinking of like other artists, you know, you say that you're not a sculptor. What artists were you looking to when you were growing up? Or even what artists do you sort of connect with now or have a camaraderie with now?
Yeah, so when I was growing up, I was mostly only aware of the work that was on the walls of my home. And my parents, my grandmother was actually on the board of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York when she was, and she was on a lot of different boards. She was really active in the arts in New York City.
Collector, right?
She collected work, but of Black artists. She was kind of friends and peers. We had Ramar Bearden and Hale Woodruff in the house.
And Faith Ringgold.
I love Faith Ringgold so much. I'm like totally obsessed. But whether they were posters or original works of art, they had been passed on from my grandmother to my mother and my mom. So that was in our house growing up. And that was the work that I knew. I knew mainly Black artists of a certain time. And then when I got to Yale, it was one of the first times that I was introduced to artists such as like Alice Neal or even contemporaries, Mickling Thomas or Kehinde Wiley were two figurative painters that had gone through the Yale program that I became aware of once I was there as well. And now it's unbelievable. I'm most inspired by my students. That sounds like really cliche, but in a lot of ways, like I'm really inspired by the things that they do because they're uninhibited by the pressures or the expectations that the art world puts on us artists. And the things that they make feel really fresh and honest and raw. There's a lot of sincerity within the work that they're making that I think a lot about and am inspired by and try to bring into my own practice. But Kerry James Marshall. I mean, there are so many. I could go on and on.
I love it. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
and they're all artists that I love. So it's like every time you're saying one in my brain, I'm like, ding, ding, ding.
So
ding,
like,
ding.
I totally dawned on me as I was like preparing for teaching, right? And thinking about how I could connect my kind of Jordan Castile world to Professor Castile worlds, that there were access points for me for them. And then I was like, wait, I could like text Amy Sherald or Shabalala Self and see if they'd be willing to spend 20 minutes. Like I actually could do this and it could be really meaningful for them, whether it's Toyin or Devin Shimayama. Like these are people, Aaron Gilbert, all of them have agreed to like participate in those 20 minute kind of pop-ins. Yeah, I know. Because
I want to get in
like
on those calls.
Yes, I want to be one of your students. Know, right? Why am I not your student?
although we have been quite lucky because we've spoken to Toyin already.
And I met
Shabalala in Margate, where I live in the seaside town in England. She came down for a day. So I've hung out with her.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
I've met quite a lot of people recently. But it's
you're doing it too.
Something that I loved about what you said about your students was encouraging people to apply to everything. So we spoke with Lisa Yuskavage yesterday.
Oh, yes.
And she was talking all about these rejection letters that she'd like extensively archived and documented for numerous years. And it never really, even though it might have upset her at the time in a way, instead you just have to keep on. And
yeah.
You know, you have to sort of believe in yourself and apply.
I think once you've achieved a certain amount of success, people forget all the rejections that came before that and all the times that people told you you weren't good enough, all the times that people said that they wouldn't collaborate with you, all the times that you were rejected in various capacities. And I think it's important to remember that, because when you remember that you broke through, that there were times and places where somebody gave you an opportunity. And I do believe in applying for everything, particularly because I've been able to be on both ends of what it means to apply to something now. I've been the applicant and I've been the person who is choosing applicants and trying to, like, the selection committee. And being in the room, you really realize that those rooms change every year. And I'm always telling my students that, but like the people looking at your work often changes and what they're looking for changes. And if you don't take the chance, you never know. If I hadn't have taken the chance at Yale, I would have never gotten in the door. And I definitely didn't deem myself as being good enough. But I threw my hat in the basket just because there was something to learn from that experience. And I do believe that there's a lot to learn by being willing to take a risk in whatever capacity it is. And it happens in my practice. Now the risk-taking just goes up. Now it looks like me going up to people with the potential of being rejected.
Do you get rejected? Have you had people say no? Have you had people say no?
I haven't.
Oh, right.
I haven't. It's kind of crazy. There's been one time where somebody was really skeptical, and that's the painting of Stanley. And you see it in his eyes. I think, unlike James and Yvonne, he looks really hesitant. I look at that painting and I can't help but see his skepticism, because I approached him and he was waiting to get his hair cut. And he asked me to wait until after he had his hair cut. And I told him that I would give him a lineup in the painting because, you know, I'm a magician, that I would like take care of him. Uh-huh. And he was like, okay, ? And I took the photo and we exchanged contact information, and you feel it in that painting.
He had his vanity in order then. He was like, wait, my hair's got to look sick for this, and then you can paint me.
Exactly. He was like, I haven't had a lineup yet. And I was like, don't worry, I'll line you up in the painting. He was like,
in the studio.
Okay.
Yeah. Hilarious. I love the fact you're quoted as saying that one of your goals with, because you go into the communities and the people you're kind of painting, you're like adding value to the common man. It's the people that form solid parts of the community. But you said that one of your goals is to get these people onto the wall of a museum. That's one of your main drives.
Definitely. My intention is kind of bringing the everyday into institutional spaces, where I often feel that through kind of like various power structures that people haven't had the capacity of feeling that they belong in those spaces, nor have they been given a chance to belong in those spaces. Mm-hmm. And I really want people to know that they are valuable and that I value them and that they are worth kind of being honored in this way and living forever, that their stories are valuable for many generations to come. That's without a doubt my intention when I'm approaching someone. It's like, my goal is to get you on the wall of a museum. Mm-hmm. And to see that fulfilled now in many ways, the best moment. And Russell, you were with me at the opening, which maybe we should talk about too, at the new museum, because one of my favorite moments is when the openings happen. Yeah, the meeting. Absolutely.
I saw the photo from England and was super, had like major FOMO, fear of missing out. I was like, why am I not there? I love her so much. Yes. And now I'm finally getting to talk to you, so I'm so happy. It's like dreams.
Yeah, see, and we barely got to talk, Russell and I, that evening. So don't worry, we're all a part of it now. Because
photos always
being
make
hounded.
Things look, though, so much
exactly.
like you've
We spent hours together. We were breaking down our history. Yeah, we went for dinner. We left the opening, we ran off. Yeah, she painted me. It was really, it was intense.
It was a magical evening.
We did a lot.
Yeah, we did a lot. We did the whole thing. But one of my favorite things about the openings, what I love that you got to witness too, is that the subjects come and that it is about them kind of bearing witness to this moment and being participants, that they were all meeting each other and introducing themselves to each other. Some of them were posting up in front of their paintings and like shaking hands with people that that it really was like a celebration. I haven't been to an opening at New Museum that felt quite like that evening felt. Mm. Like, you went to my floor and the energy was unlike anything.
Amazing.
Oh, it was amazing. Like, people
didn't
were
you have one of your sitters?
Happy.
Didn't you have one of your subjects was downstairs and someone came and found him from the museum because they
yes,
recognized him
my
and
student,
then led him
Emmanuel.
Up VIP style up to his...
Oh, he was living a dream. But he also made a very poignant observation. The next kind of class that I had after the opening, where he is a student of mine still currently, and I asked him to share with the group what his experience was like at the opening. And he said, well, the first thing that caught my attention was that somebody recognized me and shepherded me upstairs and said, oh, you're one of, you know, the subjects in the work. Let me take you upstairs. And how kind of amazing that was for him as somebody who hadn't experienced that before in a space like that. He had been to the New Museum before and felt like he had to kind of follow it. Had certain P's and Q's he needed to follow.
Yes.
But then he got upstairs and he said that even though he felt outnumbered in terms of, as there weren't, even within that crowd, there weren't that many people of color, that he was still one of a few, but he felt right. validated by the fact that he was on the wall and so yes. were all of his friends, that he would look up above the crowd and he'd be like, she has my back. He has my back, like, oh, my boy Johnny's right. over here. Like, I actually do belong. Like, this is for me and about me. So I'm going to, like, sit in this space because it's for me. And so all the rest of it didn't matter, that he didn't really pay any mind to who he was talking to. And I also love that people, you could have a billionaire or a very famous collector or curator in the room. And my yep. students may or may not know that, and or the subjects, but there was an equalizing factor that
yes,
night. Everybody was on the same playing field. Yeah, everybody was on the same playing field. Students would walk up to somebody and say, "What brought you here?" And they'd be like, "Oh, I'm the curator of the exhibition." Like, "Oh, excuse me. Okay, well, I'm on the wall." You know, like all of a sudden we're just as important.
That's really though what art can do. You know, art can create space. And a platform, you know, for other people, like it's
yes.
You know, for your friends or for your family or for, you know, for other people around the world, like it's a amazing, powerful thing, really.
It is one of the best things I think art can offer, is the ability to see ourselves represented and to see history represented. I was telling my students, even in this time and in this moment, is that artists throughout history, during times of tragedy or shift in society, that we are the ones to capture that in whatever means that we can, that it's through our kind of creative gesture and observations that we can tell the story for generations to come. Right. And that's a pretty powerful place to be in,
yes.
to think that you can kind of document a time empathetically.
You can make a change.
Yeah, exactly.
And also, I actually feel like your work's changing now. You know, I think you're actually, as well as changing in, you know, being there for the future generations, I feel like it is having a big impact on everyone now, which is also a really wonderful gift for you, I guess, to be able to experience that.
Yeah, it is. It's a wonderful experience, but it's mind-boggling to me the way that social media functions, that I can post an image and people are commenting on that image, that seeing Lean, for example, I posted a few days ago on my Instagram, and there were a lot of comments about kind of seeing tenderness represented in at this time in the world where we're all
yes.
feeling kind of apart and in our separate spaces, to feel kind of that security within an image really meant something to them from their various homes. Like that's pretty amazing. Like it's crazy to think that imagery has the power to make someone feel seen and heard and validated in their feelings, whatever that might be.
That's culture. Culture moves. Culture changes things. That's what art does. It changes the world. That's why they want to get rid of it. That's why they're trying to stop people having that opportunity.
True.
It's like, it's crazy.
Yeah.
So we ask every
That's
guest that comes on two questions. The first one is, if you could do an imaginary art heist, you can steal any work of art in the world you want and you can live with it yourself, what would it be and why? And it can be absolutely anything.
It can be huge as well. We have cranes and planes and helicopters, anything you need.
Oh, my gosh.
There for you.
Oh, my gosh. That's a great question. What my I've gone through like three different paintings in my head already, and I'm like, ooh, but which one's more valuable? And which one would I actually
tell us
live
all
with?
If you want?
And it's a painting, though. That's interesting. It's definitely a painting.
It's definitely a painting. I mean, there, I would take any Carrie James Marshall off any wall, any place, and love to kind of like steal that. It, I can't even name one in particular, and I would die to
the
live
with that.
The
entire show at the Whitney.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Can I take the whole show?
The Met.
Can you guys figure out a way to make that box for
Oh, the Met, sorry.
Yeah, the Met, yeah.
The Met, exactly.
The entire show at the Met.
It's totally, I mean, I've already talked about this painting for another, like for the New York Times, like little video, but the Faith Ringgold, the Alice Neal painting of Faith Ringgold is definitely another painting that I would steal and love to live with,
or share
with the world. It's fantastic. Alice Neal painted Faith Ringgold and it's really great. And she has these, she's sitting in this red dress on a chair and it's like all patterned and it makes me think of those floral couches that I've painted. Like, I just love the patterning, and she's so relaxed and looks incredibly regal. Love that painting. So that's probably, those are the two things that come to mind that I would
Did your grandmother
steal.
Ever meet Alice Neal?
I don't think so. Right. I don't think so. I don't know, actually. I was too young to, like, have the capacity to ask her such a question when she passed away, but I would be curious.
Where is her collection now? Is that part of the family?
Yeah, it's in my mom's house, mostly hanging out. It's my
in
mom,
Denver.
In Denver, Denver, Colorado. And then my mom jokes that now she has Jordan Castile's hanging out in the basement as well, which is stressing her out because I basically have stored a lot
Storage.
Of stuff down there.
Oh, God. Yeah,
exactly.
Do you collect? Do you collect other artists' work?
I mean, I haven't collected on a formal, in like a formal capacity, but when I was in graduate school, you know, at the end of the school year, we would all trade. And so I have the work of a lot of my classmates through trades that we did when we were in graduate school. I have Heidi Hahn is like one of my favorite contemporary peers, like painters. She is, I love her paintings and the way she uses the material. And I have two of hers somehow. I don't know how that happens, but I'm not complaining. And what else do I have on my wall?
It's quite good timing because you can actually look around
right?
and see.
I'm like, yeah, let me actually, what else do I have on my wall? I have a Wade McIntosh. I have a Sam Messer. I have Genevieve Gagnard. I have Alex Bradley. Cohen, I have an AWOL Orisku photograph he did of me. So it's like there's like a weird hodgepodge on my wall, but collecting once I have the space, I also am in a New York apartment, studio apartment. So the idea of collecting has not spread immensely yet because I
not
can't
the space
spread.
Capacity.
Yeah, literally can't spread very
So
far
the other
right
the
now.
Other question we ask every guest is what is your favorite color?
I used to say, and I said, right, can I just say a rainbow? The first thing I learned to do was like a rainbow. And my mom jokes that I used to do it for my brother in preschool because once I realized what a rainbow was, I would do a rainbow on everything. And to this day, if I could just like color a rainbow, it's all of them. Like maybe you can make every color from a rainbow. Ooh, so
a good
I know
answer.
That's not
no
one
one's
color,
ever given us
but
that.
No one's ever given
really?
Us that.
Brilliant.
Okay, well, because it's a cop out for not giving you one color, that's what it is. But
but it I also makes less. Sense for your it makes sense for your personality, Jordan. You have like a rainbow effervescent personality, which I think shines through your work as well,
and optimism,
why you're incredibly popular as well, because you have the work which is just incredible, but you as a human is just so appealing. You're so lovely. It's like you got this like, wonderful.
I also
openness.
Feel like I also really respond to the kindness, like the thoughtfulness and the care you take, and not just about your own art, but other people's art. And I just find that kindness and generosity of spirit like something we have to celebrate more in this world.
That means a lot to me because I do think that if we all just like take the time to slow down enough to like think, when I enter my classroom, I enter the classroom aware that my students experience something that morning that I may or may not be aware, like acutely aware of, nor will they tell me. But if you through the practice of empathy, you can recognize that we're all coming to the table with a lot of different experiences, and there are good days and there are bad days. But if I can like sit with the potential that you are a complex human being, then really magnificent things can happen because you get to see truth and truth is, you know, a powerful thing. Yes. So,
wow. Jordan. Awesome. We've got one more question for you, actually, because we're doing bonuses, which
Ooh,
is
bonus.
What is your hidden, you've just discovered your hidden lockdown talent, something you didn't know you could do until we've all been in quarantine?
Or something that you want to encourage?
Oh, I might hit it. Like, okay, so my boyfriend, he's been joking because he's like, you are mastering everything and it's making me feel quite fragile right now because I've given him a haircut and I did it quite well. I was thoroughly proud of myself. Hidden talent. I might start becoming a barber. No, anyway, definitely gonna not actually cut his hair ever again, potentially. He said it's a little hipstery because half of it is not, like, one side is more blended than the other. There's like a bowl cut on one side, but he trusts me enough to do it and making bread.
Wow.
Yeah.
And making bread. You just said sourdough. Wow.
Yeah. I've been sourdough baking quite a lot lately. Like, I might look like a loaf of bread when this is all over. I've been doing this so much. Like, it's totally possible. Half of me is going to be a bowl of mac and cheese. The other half is going to be a loaf of bread. Yeah, exactly. So
I love
I've been making
delicious,
a lot of bread.
Delicious combination.
And it's coming out like my first loaf. I was so proud of it. I was like, hidden talent. I didn't even know. If all else fails, I'll have
creativity,
a bakery barbershop.
Exactly. What, a bakery barbershop. Yeah. Not very hygienic, but
no, not very
there, getting in the bread.
You know, I'll develop some kind of walls between. Get your haircut, come up at the
get
front.
Get your haircut,
for the
bake a loaf.
Yeah. Something I've been having to really relax because I normally get my haircut every 3 weeks or something, and I've just had to let it all grow out and my beard.
Yep.
And I'm beginning just to look like not like me, but it's a new me, so it's fine. But because I don't have anyone here to cut my hair, so maybe I'll. Maybe I'll call you when I get to New York.
Eventually. I got you. Well,
sending so much love to you, and
thanks, Jordan. This has been amazing.
Super massive privilege to spend this hour with you. I've loved every
likewise.
Minute, and you've brought light and joy to my day. So thank you.
Oh, and, likewise. I really appreciate it.
For images of all the artworks we've discussed today, you can visit our Instagram at TalkArt. And Jordan,
you're on Instagram, aren't you? Yeah.
Yes, I am on Instagram. And my handle's just Jordan M. Castile. My middle name's Margaret. At the time, Jordan Castile was taken. So it's Jordan M. Castile.
Amazing. Well, we should get them to follow you and check that out.
And you can also find images of Jordan's works at Casey Kaplan Gallery. And I'd like to say thank you to them because they've been very supportive and lovely.
Yes, it's been amazing.
And we will be back very soon. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jordan.
Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diament and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.